thank you. That was so great, Ruba. So thank you, Chris and Joan, for inviting me to participate in this opening of the Hemingway series for 2021. And thank you, Anna, for hosting at the White Whale. I'm excited to be reading with Ruba and Jeff and Rosalie. Thank you all so much. I'm going to read a few poems. And I just want to give a little context, which will suffice for all of them in some way. My father in 1965 was beaten by cops and taken to a state hospital for the criminally insane. And people always ask me, well, was he insane? And I always say, no, he wasn't insane. He was just a Black man with a voice, and he was not going to stand being silent. So in that broad context, all the poems kind of relate to that in some way. My first poem that I'm going to read is called Anatomy of a System. A jar of formaldehyde at the back of the room is labeled bullfrog. Kingdom Animalia, phylum Crodata, class Amphibia. The biology teacher is standing in the front leading a review, holds up each organ of a frog's dismembered body, clasped in tweezers, each part dangles. I don't know yet how men are classified at the state hospital for the criminally insane. I only know that my father is there. I don't know that men are labeled by race, Black, Negro, gender, male, attitude, threatening, mental capacity, 12-year-old, notes, seems to have his own philosophy about his place in society, diagnosis, schizophrenic. On the day of the biology test, the frog is spread out around the room. Each piece of its innards is stretched on a bed of cotton, held with straight pins to keep it from shriveling. Clipboard in hand, I walk to each station, identify the organ or blob of flesh. A white boy behind me pokes the hard edge of his pressed article board into the small of my back. He wants to see my answers. I don't know yet the answers institution officials give to questions about the death of a man, that when his body is exhumed, it is empty, all of his internal organs gone, even his brain. Cause of death recorded is heart attack. I record answers on my paper. The white boy is breathing on my neck. I hold my clipboard up for him to see, and he copies liver. I erase it, write heart. After he copies stomach, I scratch it, write large intestine. I don't know yet that a man is kicked so hard in the stomach he shits himself, that his intestines hurt for 5 years after that, that he pisses blood for 3 months. When the bell rings, I erase testes, right brain. I don't know yet that my father is being systematically erased for 6 1/2 years, that he will rewrite his life as he reorients his body to not pin down. I usually don't try to give any introduction to my poems. I kind of just read them. So this next poem is Leaving a Small House for College, Knowing What I Have Already Learned. Here in the bucket seat of my brother's new Mustang, with my mother on the porch waving goodbye, I see smoke from her Viceroy cigarette float up. I am already lightheaded. Try to catch my breath and make sense of silences that have sheltered me for 3 years. I am pulling away from nights the Black radio station played hits from Motown. There was always music. Dance contest in the living room, girls against boys, the Supremes challenging the Temptations. I was a fragile Diana Ross, skinny girl with a wide open mouth, Ronrico rum thinning my voice to a high-strung vibration. I wanted to be numb. It didn't matter if I later stumbled or crawled to the bathroom and wrenched up the music note by note. Slept so hard, I forgot how madly I danced in a darkness that drove me. I didn't know where I was going, only that I wanted to get to what is next. I waved back. Can she see me? Or has she stopped seeing me years before as we ate in silence at the kitchen table? Where in the measured quiet, I pictured my father blessing the food, head bowed, his voice extended in prayer, me pretending meekness when I whispered my verse, Jesus wept. Unholy as I am, I don't cry that I carry silence with me, have thrown it into mismatched suitcases and will wear it like old underwear to all my college classes. Nobody needs to see what has sobered me, what I carry underneath. So the next poem, I guess I will give a little kind of introduction, is in my small neighborhood of community of Black people. Well, we kind of always kept track of who was coming and who was going to make sure that everybody was going to be okay. So this next poem is called Keeping Track. And it's Keeping Track. On my father's 72nd birthday, he stared out the kitchen window. He used to announce who was coming down the street, and my mother would say, okay, after each name. That's how they kept track of people making it back home. If it was a carload of women coming from work for rich folks, he called out each name as they stepped from the car like a debutante, though she wore an apron and her ankles were swollen. If it was the preacher on his way to the pulpit, he would describe the guitar slung across his body, how he walked the way a man walks on his way to play the blues at the bar. Be a star people looked up to for the way his music forgives. It was never a matter of belief in God. It was always a matter of being good. He can't see who is coming home anymore, but looks anyway. Philodendron leaves had grown wickedly over the window. Inside his head, he keeps the good book of names, gathers his frayed robe around his body, lets the oxygen tube hang beneath each nostril, as if he knows no matter how much air he takes in, it won't be long before the sleek hearse comes gunning its engine on the downshift. He will say to my mother, Sheffield's coming, and she will say, okay, but neither will keep track this time. This next poem is Girls Are Gods Too. And it's gone through several iterations to make it to the page like this, and it yet may change again. Girls Are Gods Too. 2 miles down in the dark, I turn left onto a dirt road that leads to Bob Ray's junkyard. Squeeze through a barbed wire fence where I have trampled bramble and burr, training my body to weave between thickets and barely getting a scratch deep enough to bleed. I sneak past piles of scrap iron and salvageable car parts, pieces of machinery that can be screwed or welded to make something broken whole again, like a body closed off after being wrecked. The old mare I've come for is tied with a rope to a banged up car door. It stirs and dances a rusty trot until it recognizes my scent. It's like times like this I've walked up on those who knew me well, but still got the jitters. That's how I learned the nature of an animal to be a beast. I pet the long neck, untie the rope, lead it into the night and ride bareback to the alley behind my house. Race up and down to see its hide turn silvery brown in skeins of moonlight. I let the rope fly, no need for reins. Blackness has its own charge. I hug the thick neck and feel matted mane against my cheek as I lean into altitudes of freedom. With legs pressed hard against side barrel muscles, I dig my heels in until I feel passion rise, explode in my pores, wild as Pegasus must have felt when he bursts within from Medusa's neck with capacity to be divine. I just said that I wasn't going to give introductions, but here I find myself doing that. Use slippers. This poem is about my mother, who would bring home little gifts that the rich lady gave her, which were always used. So in this case, it was a pair of slippers. used slippers. When the rich lady she cleaned for handed my mother a tattered pair of slippers, she smiled, said she could get some use out of them, claimed she loves pink. Even though they were too big and her feet would never grow into them, she danced across linoleum as if in a ballroom far from our small kitchen. Away from task, chipped saucers and cracked cups, from scraping food from my plate onto hers to not waste a bit. I hated those slippers. How she danced in them, holding a chicken wing stretched apart and hanging over the palm of her hand. Like a string of pearls drooping, she plucked slivers of sinewy meat. Her face blushed with the taste of sweet flesh on the tongue when she held up a clean bone that showed how we straddled the edge of poor. And though I did not starve to death, I was filled with light from a 40-watt bulb shining on a solo woman two-stepping between rhythms of contradictions. She has gone 20 years now, and I am locked down under threat of disease, even death. Honestly, I don't want to die. Think, if not me, who then will say how she taught me to dance alone under a brief light, like a firefly flashing in the dark, my small hand reaching up to catch its glow. I felt like two before. My dad finally, not finally, but did come home after 6.5 years in the state hospital for the criminally insane. And when he came home, he just wanted to work for himself. He did not want to work for anyone. And so he made his way. This poem is called What Soil Makes. And there's a term here, gone dead, which I kind of created to mean that a person is gone, not seen, put away, but dead in a certain sense. So gone dead, not particularly dead underground, but gone unseen for quite a while. What soil makes? Out of the gone dead sanctuary comes a man with a dream of free. Beneath flesh and inside his bones is the marrow of future. Though his shoulders curl inward, I ache to see his bare muscular back bent under the hood of his red pickup, the one he painted his name freehand on the door to show ownership. He added, and sons, with hope to pass on not a landscaping business, but ability to belong to oneself. My brothers laughed when they saw it, each falling into the other, their boy bodies hugging in their frailty. I did not laugh. I could see what my father's eyes held. Though I am not a boy, I picked up the rake and dragged its rusted teeth across a patch of wilted brown grass. In each small ditch of earth, I placed seeds, covered them with dirt, offered handfuls of water to quench a thirst. My brothers would never dream as free as my father did, to reseed, begin again from soil and endure tenderness of new growth, cut and shape bare twigs of forsythia to prepare for the impossibly burst of yellow blossoms, dig up half-wit stumps, plant two yew trees with roots that grow straight through the eyes of the dead, hold them tethered in their down under. They can never be green again. No ambition to unload the dump of steaming manure. Shovel shit never, my brother said. We'll not plant geraniums and peonies ever. And one small detail about the phone number painted on the trunk, they knew it by heart. And my last poem, thank you so much for everyone for coming out to the Zoom activity. Thank you, Joan and Chris again, and thank you, Anna at the White Whale. I so appreciate this opportunity. Thank you so much. Lastly, a small sacrifice. Again and again, the house finch barreled its body head first into the living room window, kept up its frantic flight until the fourth plunk sent the small thing crashing to the porch. I watched it for a while before getting on with calling the snap peas. The finch was either unconscious or dead. I looked intently for a few minutes more, hoping to detect a slight flutter of a feather. Nothing. After an hour, I checked, and there it lay, still. I began to question the time it takes for a bird to die from crashing into its own reflection, attracted to the hunger it had seen inside itself that made it want to get at the faceless dark body. When I peered again, I felt a twitch of pity growing inside the space in which I see myself. I could spare a bit for a kindred life, trying so hard to get to the inside, to fly into spaces where I'm not only an image. The common house finch lay quiet and unknowable, reminding me how silent hurt can be, how it can lay stiff in fragile bones. All night I dreamed of the bird, how cute it is, wondered if it will be there in the morning. Will it have come to its senses, flown away into the madness of branches? Or will a dark predator, an owl, a night hawk, or a prowling cat find delicious the small mouthful of desperation with which the bird struggled to be at one with itself, then falling together with its image and landing in one thud, teaching me how wonderful light is. Thank you so much.